inviting me. I'm very happy to be able to report on this recent work, so at the interface between the gravitational cell force and post-Newtonian theory. So our objective in the end would be to compute gravitational wave templates for compact binaries, and I would just like to just shortly remind you what are the methods that we have to compute these templates. I'm going to be interested in non-spinning binaries, so here I just plot the distance between the two bodies as a function of the mass ratio. And if the distance between the two bodies is large, then one can solve Einstein field equations in powers of the orbital velocity divided by the speed of light using post-Newtonian expansions. And this gives a very accurate description of inspiraling compact binaries, either a binary neutron star or binary black holes, supermassive or not. And that works also for extreme mass ratio in spirals, but only if the distance is very large, so in the weak field regime. Now, you can do better if you are interested in emeries using perturbation theory, where you treat the spacetime as a small perturbation of the geometry created by the supermassive black hole. And perturbation theory allows you to model the dynamics and the gravitational wave emission of these sources also in the strong field regime here. So clearly, perturbation theory and post-Newtonian theory are very complementary tools, and they can be compared here in the case of an extreme mass ratio binary orbiting at a large distance. But in the opposite case, if you have a comparable mass binary on the verge of merging, then both approximation schemes break down, and you need to solve Einstein equation of supercomputer. So that's numerical relativity, and people now routinely perform this binary black hole evolution since 2005. And I would say that these three methods here are, in some sense, fundamental, and then there is a fourth one which is derived from these three, and that's the effective body approach, which tries to capture information from post-Newtonian theory, perturbation theory, and also numerical relativity by fitting to waveforms in order to provide templates which would be valid in the whole parameter space. And I shall not say much more about EOB today, because I want to tell you about recent work where the post-Newtonian formalism has been compared to the cell force formalism. Namely, not just computing, a flux of gravitational waves from a particle orbiting on a geodesic of background spacetime, but the cell force, or the effects of the perturbation of the motion of the compact body itself. And my talk will be divided in four parts. First, I will shortly remind you that there is already a long history of comparison between post-Newtonian theory and the cell force approach, through comparison of the dissipative part of the cell force. And then I will focus on more recent comparisons. Actually, we heard about a couple of them this morning with Leo. And these are comparisons between post-Newtonian theory and the conservative piece of the cell force. I will briefly mention two of these, namely the ISCO shift induced by the cell force and the periapsis shift induced by the cell force, because these are very recent works, and actually in the case of the periapsis, which have not been published yet. And I will mainly focus on the last comparison, which dates back to last year and this year, and give you a lot of details on how the post-Newtonian calculation proceeds, and then how it compares with the cell force prediction. So before I move on, just I would like to precise what my notation are going to be, because in the cell force community and in the post-Newtonian community, people don't use the same, and actually can be, you see there's this new here, which doesn't have the same signification as this new here. So I'm gonna use the post-Newtonian conventions, where M1 will be the mass of the particle, the small compact object, and M2 the mass of the supermassive black hole. Little m would be the total mass, mu the reduced mass, nu, which is sometimes denoted eta, also will be the symmetric mass ratio, which varies between 0 and 1/4, and the usual mass ratio M1 over M2 will be denoted Q. So first, what has already been done for this kind of comparison is not a real comparison actually between the cell force and postulate theory, because it's kind of cheating. It's just taking a particle on a geodesic and looking at the flux and then comparing. It's not really computing the cell force itself. And before I show you how this comparison works, let me just say a few words about the post-Newtonian equations of motions, the post-Newtonian side of this comparison. The idea is that you have two compact objects and you expand the coordinate acceleration of one of the objects in powers of 1 over c. And at leading order, you have just the Newtonian acceleration, and then you have post-Newtonian corrections. So at the first post-Newtonian order and second post-Newtonian order, these are conservative corrections in the sense that there is an energy which is associated with this dynamics. But then starting at 2.5 pn order, there is a leading order radiation reaction, which is directly associated to the flux of energy, because the gravitational wave take energy away from the system. And so this is directly, in fact, related to the Einstein particle formula. After, you have another piece of conservative terms, which are very difficult to compute at the 3pn level. And then you have a 1pn correction to the leading radiation reaction. And you can keep doing that, but actually you can't, because it becomes too difficult. And this nice split between, you see, even powers of C for conservative terms and odd for dissipative terms actually breaks at the 4pn order, where I'm going to tell you. You have then 4pn terms here which are conservative and some others which are dissipative. So what people usually do to compute templates for circularized in spiraling compact binaries is, on the one hand, use the conservative part of the equations of motion to get the center of mass energy, which at Newtonian at the Newtonian level is just what you would expect here, the Newtonian binding energy, where omega is the orbital frequency, and then you have many post-Newtonian corrections. These are known up to the 3pn order right now. And on the other hand, you are going to use a wave generation formalism to compute the gravitational wave polarization, from which you can then deduce the gravitational wave energy flux. And at leading order, you get the Einstein quadrupole formula applied to the case of two compact objects on quasi-circular orbits. And then you would have also many post-Newtonian corrections. Actually, these are known up to the 3.5 pn order. And finally, you rely on an argument of energy balance, which basically says that the energy of the system decreases because it is it goes away with the wave emitted at a given flux F here. And so you have dE dt equals minus F, from which you can deduce the gravitational wave phase. There is an energy balance which is pretty similar in the perturbative case, because you can show that if you have a test particle which is orbiting a Schwarzschild black hole on a circular orbit, actually the energy of this test particle is going to decrease. And this is because the cell force is doing some work and removing energy from the particle at the precise rate which is given by the gravitational wave flux at infinity plus the gravitational wave flux that goes into the horizon. And it has been analytically shown that the gravitational wave flux that goes into the horizon is a very small effect compared to the flux at infinity, in the sense that it's a 4pn term at leading order, which means something that goes as v over c to the 8th power. So numerically, you can also show that if you consider orbits beyond the innermost stable circular orbit of Schwarzschild, outside, thank you. You're going to have a flux which is lower than 10 to the minus 3, the flux at infinity. So if you're ready to just, you know, neglect this little piece here, basically the flux at infinity effectively measures the dissipative effect of the cell force in the case of a circular orbit. So what has been done 10 and 15 years ago, actually, is a computation of this gravitational wave flux here at infinity up to very high post-Newtonian orders. And as you can see here, people starting by Eric in 1983 have been computing post-Newtonian corrections to the leading order Newtonian flux here in this perturbative approach up to the very high 5.5 PN order, which means terms of order 1 over C to the 11 here. And one nice thing that you can do is to just restrict yourself to the 3.5 PN terms here, and then go back to your post-Newtonian flux and make the mass ratio go to 0 and check that the two results agree. And they do agree, as a matter of fact. You can do similar comparisons in the case of a Kerr black hole, for example, and every time you have post-Newtonian results available for the comparison, it does work. So the conclusion is that the dissipative part of the cell force has been successively tested against post-Newtonian theory. But more recently, there has been a lot of progress in the cell force community, such that people are now capable of extracting interesting physical information from the cell force calculation, as Leor showed you this morning. And so we have new ground for comparison between the cell force and the post-Newtonian approach in the case of conservative effects induced by the cell force. So I'm going to briefly remind you of what we heard this morning and the days before about the shift of the Schwarzschild innermost stable circular orbit induced by the gravitational cell force. If you switch off the dissipative sector of the cell force, you can compute some cell force correction here proportional to the mass ratio to the result that you would get for Schwarzschild for the frequency of the ISCO, which is 6⁻³½. And by doing a numerical cell force analysis, you can actually compute the exact modulus and numerical error value of this cell force correction here. And that's the number you get. It does not coincide with the number you saw this morning because I'm including here the mass of the small particle. So in fact, if you put just the mass of the black hole here, you have to remove one here and you get 0.25. That's what Leor showed you. Here I'm putting the mass of the big particle. That's why I have 1.25. And actually, since the beginning of 2000, we have in hand the full 3PN equations of motion, and in particular, the conservative sector of these equations of motion. So we are able also to compute the shift. I mean, we're able to compute the ECO defined by the minimum of the binding energy, but we can also restrict ourselves to the extreme mass ratio limit and try to compute this number in post-Newtonian theory. And so if you do that by using some stability analysis of the equations of motion, you get this number here, which is basically 15% accurate. And I should precise that we are talking about some very relativistic regime here, because at the ISPO, clearly, you are very in a very relativistic regime, and so you should not be expected to have such a disagreement at the 3PN level at the ISPO. That being said, it has been shown that in the case of a comparable mass binary, you expect the post-Newton expansion to converge faster to the exact result that in the extreme mass ratio case where you have this pole at the light ring. So yesterday we heard a very interesting talk by Mark Favata, who presented actually some sort of extensive list of computations of this number C omega here using different method of resummed post-Newtonian calculations or EOB calculations or not resummed, etc. And I've extracted some of his conclusions here, which are that the best agreement you can get among these something like 20 different calculations is with EOB in the case where you have adjusted some pseudo 4PN coefficient with numerical relativity calculations. So that's pretty nice because it shows that even though you have fixed this number in a comparable mass regime, when you do the computation in the extreme mass ratio regime, you still get a good agreement with the exact result, so approximately 10%. But on the other hand, he showed that if you consider just the standard uncalibrated EOB, you end up with a result which is three times worse, namely a 30% error. So one may wonder if this agreement here is accidental or not. And keep in mind that even though EOB is designed to recover the exact test particle limit by construction, when you start moving a little next to this exact test particle limit by including the first correction in the mass ratio, you are pretty far off of the exact result that was computed here. And among all the uncalibrated methods, the one that gives the best agreement is actually provided by this number I gave you before in the case of the stability analysis of the Supian equations of motion. So the conclusion is that the only reliable methods, at least in the case of the computation of the shift of the Schwarzschild ISPO, are standard PN or tuned EOB. I'm going to say a few words about something that we heard this morning. And I'm not going to say much because Leo spent more time discussing it than I was expecting. So it's this, that's not a report. It's this Periapsis advance shift due to the conservative path of the south forks. So I remind you that he introduced this Periapsis advance delta, which is essentially the ratio of the two orbital frequencies. And then, because it was more convenient, he looked at the square of the inverse of that. And there must be some Schwarzschild contribution, the result you would get if there was no south force. And then a first order correction in the mass ratio, which he called rho. And then you would have both self force corrections, etc. And if you restrict yourself to vanishingly small eccentricities, you end up with an effect here, which is going to depend on the orbital frequency omega, which is usually parameterized by the, usually you use a post-Newtonian parameter x, which is m omega to the 2/3, which is about d squared over c squared instead of omega. And so he showed us this rho of x, which I show you again. And I guess all I'm going to say is that basically when the distance is very large, you're happy because you see that the post-Newtonian actually is the EOB prediction, but which is based on post-Newtonian equations of motion. So recovers the exact result. And then there is some disagreement when you go closer and closer to the ISPO. And I won't say more about this. I'm now going to spend the end of the talk talking about another comparison that has been made between the conservative part of the cell force and post-Newtonian theory. And this is the case of the comparison of the redshift observable that we have heard of during these two previous days. So to set the stage, you consider only the conservative part of the dynamics in both the cell force and the post-Newtonian approach, and you restrict yourself to circular orbits in the Schwarzschild geometry. So that means that you're going to have some helical Killing vector k here, which asymptotically is going to have this form, dt plus omega d phi, or at least you choose to restrict yourself to these coordinate systems in Pn or gauges in the cell force, such that k has this form asymptotically. And then, I should say that omega is obviously the orbital frequency of the motion. And then you can imagine that you are sitting on the particle, and because you are on a circular orbit and fully falling, you basically see no change, nothing happens to you, which means that the four velocity here of the particle is collinear to the Killing vector evaluated at the location of the particle. And this coefficient, which is a proportionality coefficient, is by definition here scalar, because these are two four vectors. And so you end up with a relation ut of omega, which is well-defined in both post-Newtonian and self-force approaches, and is gauge invariant for this restricted class of gauges here. So it's nice because now you can compute this function in both approaches and check if they agree or not in the extreme mass spatial regime when the two bodies are far away. So just a few words about physical interpretations of this quantity U capital T. First, if you restrict yourself now to gauges where the Killing vector actually reads like this, not only asymptotically but everywhere, then in particular the time component of this Killing vector at the location of the particle is going to be 1. Okay, and so that means that if the time component of this is 1, then ut is equal to the time component of the four velocity of the small particle. So you can think of this redshift observable as the time component of the four velocity of the particle. And actually, it's called redshift observable because it's related to a Gedanken experiment where you would actually send photons from the particle along the axis of rotation. And if the photon has some energy epsilon m, when it was emitted, then the photon which is received at psi plus is basically given by ut. That was shown by Steven Detweiler in his 2008 paper. So I'm going to talk about this ut as a redshift observable very often until the end of the talk. So what we want to do now is to compute ut as a function of the orbital frequency of the orbit in both post-Newtonian and self-force approach. So we are considering a binary in circular orbit with an orbital frequency omega and post-Newtonian parameter x here. And we also introduce a mass ratio q, okay, m1 over m2. So in the self-force calculation, what you end up with is that ut is the result you would get if there was no self-force, so the Schwarzschild result, which does not depend on the mass of the small particle. And because you are doing self-force calculation, there is a first-order perturbation to this, which is given by the regularized metric at the location of the particle contracted by the background for velocity. And this is of order the mass ratio. It is of order the mass of the small particle. Okay. So I won't detail how Steve and Bernard compute this thing because we had 2 days to discuss this during the CAPRA meeting. So I'm going to mainly focus on the post-Newtonian calculation of this. And in the end, once I have shown you how we get the post-Newtonian result, we're going to go back to this calculation and try to compare the two. So this comparison actually was initiated by Steven Detweiler in 2008, when he got this UT function as a function of omega, and then used 2PN accurate results, which were known, to compute this thing in post-Newtonian theory at the 2PN order. And what I'm going to tell you about is the extension of this 2PN calculation to 3PN, which, as I told you, is much more complicated because basically there's a bunch of terms, much more terms and much more complicated integrals and stuff like that. And also, we're going to see that there's going to be some log terms at even higher post-Newtonian orders that we can compute to make the comparison more accurate. So the result in post-Newtonian theory is going to necessarily look like this. It's going to be an expansion in powers of the orbital frequency with coefficients which depend on the mass ratio. And this result is valid for any mass ratio. And in the end, we're going to expand the post-Newtonian result in powers of the mass ratio, in powers of Q, and keep the leading order part in the mass ratio and compare with this, which is accurate to linear leading order in the mass ratio. So that's the plan of the comparison. So why is such a comparison important? Actually, there would be many reasons, but I'm just going to mention a technical one. It's because even though we should, in principle, be doing all these calculations using extended bodies, it's much more easy and convenient to use point particles. But the problem when you do that is that you introduce the singular field of the point particle, which you need to carefully remove. And you need to use some regularization scheme. And it is absolutely not obvious that when you use your two approximation schemes up to very high orders, you're going to end up with results which are still consistent. So it's very important to actually check that it is the case, and that even though people in the self-force use the Modson regularization detailed by Leo this morning, or people in PN use dimensional regularization, which is completely different, in the end, you compare and you see that it works. So that's why, that's one reason why it's very important to do such a comparison. So I'm going to go into the more technical part of the talk now, but not too much. So first, how do we compute this redshift observable UT in post-Newtonian theory? Basically, it's the time component of the four velocity, so it's just given by the contraction of the metric, which is computed at the location of the particle, with the coordinate velocity of the particle. But you need to compute this thing, the metric here, at the location of the particle. And as I said, here we are using point particles, so this thing is actually ill-defined if you do not regularize the divergent self field of the particle. So we're going to have to use some regularization scheme to remove this divergent self field, and this is going to be dimensional regularization. You may wonder why we actually have work to do to compute this at 3PN order, because as I told you, we already know the equations of motion at 3PN order. And this is because to compute the equations at 3PN order, you need the regularized gradient of the metric and not the regularized metric itself. And the two operations do not commute. So in this case, when we want to compute UT at 3PN order, it's the metric itself that we need to regularize at the 3PN order. And that's why there is more work to do than just apply the known results. And as we are going to see, we can actually do more than compute this thing at the 3PN order. We can go up to the 4PN and even 5PN order in the case of terms which are logarithmic, because they are easier to isolate. But let me start by discussing first the 3PN calculation of this regularized metric in post-Newtonian theory. So as I said, we use dimensional regularization, which is something which is not very well known in the gravity community, but extremely well known in high energy physics. It has been introduced in the 70s by people doing quantum field theory to regularize divergent integrals while still respecting the gauge symmetry of the theories. And here we're going to use dimensional regularization as a very powerful tool to regularize the divergent self field of our two particles here, while preserving the gauge symmetry, which is associated with the diffeomorphism invariance of GR. So to give you an idea of how it works, I just here consider the case of the Newtonian potential generated by two point particles. And basically, we're just interested in the time component of the metric. And it's just minus 1 plus the Newtonian potential, OK? So M1 over R1. R1 is the distance between the field point where you compute your metric and the particle. And then there is M2 over R2 for particle 2. So clearly, if you want to compute this metric at the location of particle 1, R1 goes to 0, and this blows up because it's a divergent Newtonian self field of particle 1. So you need some prescription to remove this term in order to get a finite and meaningful answer. The idea of dimensional regularization is that first, you do not do your computation in three space dimensions. You do it in an arbitrary integral number, d of space dimensions. And so instead of having a Newtonian potential that goes as 1 over r, you have a Newtonian potential that goes as 1 over r to the power d minus 2. And then the trick is to perform an analytic continuation in the space dimensions, which means that you are promoting the space dimension to some arbitrary complex number. It's not anymore an integer. It's an arbitrary number in the complex plane. And in particular, if you choose the real part of your dimension to be lower than 2, then you see that this is going to be perfectly regular when you make the field point x go to the position of the particle y1. And so you're going to end up with something which does not blow up anymore. And so you have just this term here, which remains. And because you know that analytic continuation is unique in the case of functions of just which are regular enough and are functions of one complex parameter, then you can just make your dimension d go to 3 in the end of the calculation and end up with a unique result, which is what you expect. And it's just the mass of the particle 2 divided by the distance between the two particles. So that's the idea of dimensional regularization. And now what we need to do is to use it at the 3PN level and not just at the Newtonian level. So we're going to perform some iterative post-Newtonian computation of the Nielsen metric. And the idea is that you take your Einstein field equations in these space dimensions, and you are going to write it as some sort of post-Newtonian expansion in powers of some potentials, which don't have any physical meaning by themselves, but are very convenient to parameterize your calculation. And using the Einstein equations, each of these potentials has to satisfy a certain equation. And if you work in the Lorentz gauge, these look like D'Alembert equations with certain sources. These sigma here are basically delta functions. So these have compact support. This is like just a Newtonian potential here. And the higher you go in the post-Newtonian expansion, the more complicated is the source of your potential. Okay. For example, here this is a 2pn Nielsen potential, and you don't have just a compact support source, you also have a non-compact support source, which means something that is non-zero outside of the world lines of the particle. So you're going to end up with a problem which you have to deal with, which is the fact that this eventually is going to blow up if you are not careful when you invert your D'Alembert theorem. Because we are actually doing a Nielsen expansion, we're looking at the metric next to the source and not very far away, we can treat all the retardations here in the D'Alembertian as small post-Newtonian corrections to instantaneous propagation. And that means that basically, instead of having to solve D'Alembert equation, you have to solve Poisson equation, because the retardation, you put it in the right-hand side. Okay, and because we are considering conservative effects here, we don't use the retarded propagator, but what we call the propagator of the instantaneous potentials, which just basically keeps conservative effects. So you end up with having to solve Poisson equations, where instead of this D'Alembert, you have just, you know, the Poisson operator here, with very complicated sources, basically, which are here. And you do that in d-space dimension, such that the fact that you have point particles here is not a problem anymore, thanks to dimensional regularization. All the UV divergences that you have in your Poisson integral are taken care of by dimensional regularization, as I showed you in the case of the Newtonian potential. And you also have another problem you have to deal with. It's the infrared divergence, which come from the non-compact support pieces of the sources here. And these are cured using a usual regulator that you put in your source and a finite path prescription. This is something that actually has been known for a very long time, and this is not a new problem. It's just something that you have to take care with, but you know how to do it. So that's how we compute the 3PN near zone regularized metric. And actually, there's something new and interesting that appears at the 3PN order with respect to previous orders. It's the fact that you have poles now in your computation. So a pole is a term that goes as 1 over d minus 3. D is a space dimension. So it means that formally, you cannot, strictly speaking, you cannot take the limit where the dimension is equal to 3, because these terms blow up. So the result you get for your regularized metric is a pole part with terms as 1 over d minus 3, and a finite part, and eventually corrections that you're going to neglect of order epsilon. The fact that you have these poles here is not actually a problem at all. It's purely a gauge effect, because you can show that if you were doing your computation in a different gauge, you would not have such poles, for example, in ADM type coordinates. And so you know that in the end, if you compute a gauge invariant quantity, all these poles should cancel out, because these are pure gauge. So that's a very nice check of the calculation. When we compute the redshift observable as a function of the orbital frequency, we have to make sure that all these poles are going to be removed. So just for fun, I'll show you the result. In the case of the time component of the regularized metric, okay, which is just Minkowski plus the Newtonian potential, so we saw how to compute this within dimensional regularization, plus 1PN terms, so there's just 4 of them. And then there's 2PN terms, a little more. And these actually, I mean, this was known back in 1998, and that's precisely the result that Steve has been using to do the 2PN comparison. And because we want to extend the comparison to 3PN, we had to do all these computations, and we end up with much more terms here. And I just show you a couple of them, in particular to show that there is this poll I was telling you about. And if you want the full result, either it's three more slides, or you can look in the paper. Sorry? I don't remember.
I think it's what it says there. So there's a B and a C.
No, that's 2010 first paper.
Oh, I see.
I then switch to basically the result, which is once you have computed the metric, you remember you contract it with the coordinate velocity, and you have computed ut. So then this is a result which is valid for any orbit in a general reference frame. And so then you switch to the center of mass frame, you restrict your circular orbits, you do everything you need to express the result in terms of the orbital frequency, and you end up with what you are expecting, namely that the redshift observable is a function of x, the post-Newtonian parameter, which is just the orbital frequency, with a power series like that. So this is the 2PN result, which was already known. And basically, we have then the new result, which is this 3PN coefficient here, which is just a function of mass ratios. I mean, it's just a function of the mass of the two body of the two objects, M1 and M2. And it's conveniently parametrized by the symmetric mass ratio. And what's nice is that you see that in this result, there are no poles anymore. Indeed, when you do all this replacement, you observe that all these poles cancel out of the final result, as they should. And so you're actually pretty happy with that. So one thing we could do now is to expand this thing in powers of the mass ratio Q, and then just keep the leading order term in the mass ratio, which is the self-force effect, and compare with the self-force. We're not going to do that now, because we can do actually even more post-Newtonian computations in order to get a better comparison. So let me discuss the extension of this calculation to the case of 4PN and 5PN logarithmic terms. So the origin of these terms actually is well known for people of the Capra community, because it has to do with the fact that the field point at the event X here is not just related to the state of the source on the path Lycon, but on all of the interior of the path Lycon, because there is radiation which is scattered by the background curvature, which is created by the mass of the source. And while it appears as this H-tail in self-force computations, in post-Newtonian theory, it appears as this integral here. Starting at 4PN order, when you compute the near-zone metric, you see that the result is not just a function of the state of motion of the source at the retarded time, but it depends on all the paths of the source. And as you can see, this is related to the mass, which scatters the radiation. It's a 4PN effect because it's 1 over c to the 10 in the time-time component of the metric. So it depends on all the source, all the paths of the source because of this it's not a retarded integral, it's an integral on the path of the source. And this is the 7 times derivative of the quadrupole moment, and there is this logarithmic dependence here. So if there is some sort of conservative part here, that means that you're going to end up with log in the end in the redshift observable. So first of all, when you look at that, you think that's probably a dissipative effect because it's not symmetric in time. And indeed, it's true that there is a dissipative part, which actually means that the leading order 2.5 PN Burke-Thorne radiation reaction potential, which was computed by Burke and Thorne in the 70s, I think, is actually now corrected by this tail integral. And this is indeed a purely conservative effect, which has to do with gravitational radiation leaving the system. But if you go back to this expression, you see that if you isolate the log of r here, you can put it out of the integral and integrate this and end up with a conservative piece here, which goes as 1 over c to the 10. And this is a 6-time derivative of the quadrupole moment and the log. And this is symmetric if you do if you change your retarded potential by advanced potential, you're going to end up with the same term here. And that means that it is the conservative term that we are interested in for our computation of the redshift observable for circular orbits when we restrict to the conservative part of the dynamics. So I will not show you here how we extend the computation to get the next two leading order log. I can tell you after if you wish. But basically, you try to isolate these conservative logs, and then you see how they contribute to the redshift observable. And the result is as such. Now UT is not just a power series in the post-Newtonian coefficient. You see that at the 4pn order, you have also some log of x, and at the 5pn order also, and actually at all higher orders, you have these logs. And what we were able to compute are the coefficients at 4pn and 5pn in front of the logarithmic terms. And as you can see, it's kind of the same as for the 3pn coefficient. It's just a function of the two masses of the bodies. And that's valid for any mass ratio. The thing that we do not have in control are these 4pn and 5pn polynomial coefficients, because they would essentially require the same kind of computation I show you at 3pn order using dimensional regularization, but it would be much more difficult because it's even higher order. So these would be extremely difficult to compute in post-Newtonian theory, but the log terms, they are much easier to isolate, and that's why we computed them. Actually, we did not compute them just for fun, but because we realized that by knowing their value, we could get a much better fit to the cell force, and therefore to extract much more information from the cell force calculation. So I'm now going to go to the last part of the talk, which is the comparison of the post-Newtonian and cell force predictions, so the exciting stuff. If we want to compare with the cell force, we need to basically expand the redshift observable in powers of the mass ratio. And the zeroth order term will be just the Schwarzschild result. Then you have the cell force effect proportional to the mass ratio. And then you would have post cell force term, etc. And because we know this exactly up to 3pn order for any mass ratio and also with log term, we can actually compute the post-Newtonian expansion of UT, of the cell force effect, also up to 3pn order with log terms. So the result is expressed in terms of this post-Newtonian parameter y, which is basically the same as x. It's just that you use just the mass of the big black hole and not the total mass, because you've expanded in powers of the mass ratio. And the result is as such. So you have the 2pn result here, and then this new 3pn coefficient that we computed thanks to dimensional regularization, and also this 4pn logarithmic contribution and 5pn logarithmic contribution. And once again, the things we don't know are the 4pn and 5pn polynomial coefficients, which would require a huge calculation of the regularized metric at 4pn or 5pn order. And the nice thing is that even though we cannot compute this in PN, because this is a self-force effect, and because people in the CAFRA community are now able to compute this function UT as a function of the orbital frequency exactly, then we can extract from this exact result the values of the coefficients here and get insight into higher order PN terms that you would never know otherwise. That's the powerfulness of this kind of comparisons. Before I show you how we managed to get these numbers, I just want to show you another nice result, which is that we check that in the cell force data, there is actually enough precision to compute the value of the 3pn coefficient with a lot of accuracy, and a lot of precision, and then compare with the exact result you know. So the idea is that you know this thanks to the perturbative cell force calculation, and then you're going to do a post-Newtonian fit. So you have here this polynomial expansion, and then you also allow for log terms. And for the fit, what you do is that you use the known coefficients A0, A1, and A2 up to 2pn order, but you do not include the known value of the 3pn coefficient, because that's what you want to measure. Okay? So you use this information up to 2pn order, and you also use the information on the 4pn and 5pn logs that we just computed in order to get an even better fit. Actually, before, that was the motivation to compute the 4pn and 5pn logs. It's because knowing these already, we could get a better estimation of the 3pn coefficient. And so if you do the fit of the self-force calculation with this pn series, you end up with an estimation of the 3pn coefficient here, which, as you can see, is extremely precise. There are 9 significant digits here. And then what you can do is to say, hey, I know the exact result for this 3pn coefficient, so I can show it to you. It's here. And you can check that indeed there is agreement between the two numbers at the 2 sigma level with 9 significant digits. So in case you have any sort of doubt about the use of regularization with point particles, I hope that this is a very convincing argument to show that you can do it, and it does work very, very well. And you end up with results which are extremely consistent with each other in the domain of validity of both approximation schemes. So now that we are confident that basically our two calculations agree as they should, what we want to do is to extract as much information as possible in the strong field regime, which is contained in the self-force data. So what we do now is the same kind of fit, but now we use all the known values of the postmion coefficients. So we know we use the polynomial coefficients up to 3pn, and we also use the 4pn and 5pn log coefficients. And we try to fit to get the values of, for example, the 4pn polynomial coefficients that we do not know. And the result is in this table. So as you can see, we managed to get measures of the 4pn, 5pn, 6pn, and even 7pn polynomial coefficients, and to evaluate the 6pn log term here. And the 4pn numbers that I told you would be very, very difficult to compute. Thanks to the self-force calculation, you can estimate with 8 significant digits. Yesterday, Bernard gave more detail about how much you should trust these results. So I'm not going to give you more details about that, just that basically you should, roughly speaking, multiply these error estimates by 2, because we think that there is a very high precision but less accuracy that we would like. But still, you have, you know, something that you know extremely well here with very high precision. So to illustrate this graphically, I am going to end up by just showing this plot, which is the self-force contribution to the redshift observable plotted as a function of 1 over y, which you should think of as a gauge invariant measure of the orbital radius divided by the mass of the black hole. And so on the far right, the two objects are very far apart, and on the far left, they are very close to each other. And at y equals 1/6, it's the Schwarzschild telescope. So clearly here we are already in a very relativistic regime. The black dots correspond to the exact values computed thanks to the self-force, and the different color curves correspond to different post-Newtonian approximations. So clearly the Newtonian approximation is off, but already at 1pn, actually, even if your particle is like at 10m of the Schwarzschild black hole, you see that you're not that bad. Now we know all these approximations exactly up to 3pn order. If you start going at 4pn, 5pn, 6pn, 7pn, it's a little less fair because we use the values of the fit. But up to 3pn order, this is a real comparison between a post-Newtonian computation and a self-force computation. And if you check the numbers, you see that the 3pn curve is here accurate to 1% at r equals 10m, 5% at r equals 7m, and 10% at r equals 6m. So it's very consistent with what I showed you in the case of the Schwarzschild ISCO. I showed you that the 3pn estimation of the Schwarzschild ISCO shift due to the self-force was accurate to 15%. And here we see that for the redshift observable, it's the CPN result is accurate to 10%, so it's really consistent. And then all these curves are basically at higher post-Newtonian orders, either using the known values of the 4PN and 5PN logs, and also the best fit coefficients. And you see a nice you know, progression towards the exact result. So to conclude, we know that the dissipative effects of the gravitational cell force agree with post-Newtonian theory since a long time. But recently, thanks to progress in the cell force community, it has been possible to do very interesting comparisons even with conservative effects induced by the cell force with post-Newtonian theory. So I shortly told you about the ISCO shift, the Piratti shift, and I insisted mostly on the redshift observable. And in the case of this redshift observable, we could make a comparison with a very nice agreement. In particular, I showed you that if you try to fit the cell force data with a PN series, you estimate the sup-PN coefficient with a lot of precision and actually with a very nice agreement with the exact result. And that means that basically the regularization schemes which are used in both cell force and post-Newtonian theory are, I mean, can be trusted, at least in the case of this comparison, that's what it shows. And furthermore, that by knowing logarithmic contributions at higher PN order, you can really extract a lot of information from the cell force data by computing higher order PN coefficients with a lot of precision. So that means that the cell force can clearly tell us a lot about post-Newtonian theory in the extreme mass spectral regime. And hopefully there will be more comparisons like this. In particular, I have in mind this little list here. But I just would like to insist that the post-Newtonian results are available for these comparisons. They are out there, and in some sense just waiting to be used to be compared to the cell force. So this, as Leor said, could be probably done pretty quickly. For the orbits in care, we just have to wait for gravitational cell force calculations in care. And then we could also compare with a post-cell force term in the energy flux and so on. But there is one thing that has not been discussed in this CAPRA meeting, which I think is something which would be very interesting, would be to use post-Newtonian theory to get insight into the cell force. So a few ideas are maybe recovering the Misetaqua equations using a post-Newtonian formalism, or investigating what is the link between, you know, the occurrence of gravitational tails in the PN formalism or in the cell force formalism. Could be also interesting to try to compute the cell force analytically using the post-Newtonian toolkit. And to conclude, I would say that there is a prospect for a lot of interesting work and collaboration at the interface between the gravitational cell force and the post-Newtonian formalism. Thank you.
Yeah, I must admit, I'm a bit confused by the term, the logarithm term in the conservative part. Yeah. I mean, tail terms come from dissipative effects. So could you explain again why you consider the term as...
So actually, tail terms are not purely dissipative, and that's precisely what I was trying to say. Tail terms in the post-Newtonian expansion, I mean, the most general form of the near-zone metric in the post-Newtonian theory involves logarithmic terms. And what I basically showed is that these logarithmic terms, they are the conservative part associated with the gravitational wave tails. And one way to think about it would be that if you're looking at the metric, you know, next to your source, you have to have some log terms at some point, because there are also log terms in the radiative part of the metric, which are due to the tails, precisely. And these are not just, you know, a dissipative effect. There is also a conservative part. And actually, this was also shown in another comparison by Léor, the creator of the periapsis shift, because...
yeah, but I mean, this log with 10 in the conservative part then shows up in the energy function. So it's really, right?
Yeah, I mean, this log, you can actually compute what they look like in the energy function. And actually, it's in the paper where they write these functions in the energy function. And they are there.
Okay, maybe we can discuss later. Because usually, in logarithmic terms in the energy function, I mean, they're associated to, I mean, final size effects. And that they shouldn't enter at this order, to my understanding.
Well, I think we should move this to so other questions.
Small technical question. When you do your fit, do you fit all the positron orders together, or do you do them one by one?
So, as far as I understood it, maybe Bernard and Steve can tell me if I'm wrong, but I think that they do fit all the coefficients together, and so it's a chi-square when you try to get a reduced chi-square close to one, and you estimate all the positron coefficients together.
Yep. Right. So the final table that you showed does come from fitting them together. I mean, you can do it separately, but you have large remainders that are systematic, that actually represent unfitted functions. It's only if you fit them all together that you get residuals that are basically random.
Other questions?
Maybe you just answered my question. I was going to ask just what are the residuals in the fit, and you never actually showed a graph of those. Is there any interesting pattern of those residuals in the function of radius? Why, for example?
I showed it yesterday.
Okay.
I can show you that basically you have something that's essentially random around your variable.
Okay, so it really does then fit to within the terminal error.
Yes, if we let the log terms out, the things were not as satisfactory in several respects, but that's one place where it's true.
Other questions?
So I sometimes keep on hearing that post-Newtonian is an asymptotic series. This plot here looks perfectly convergent to me. Will it turn over at some point?
You have to remember that here we're doing a comparison in the extreme maxspatial case, and in, for example, in the you can construct the Schwarzschild metric iteratively in post-Newtonian theory, and you recover exactly Schwarzschild. Then, if you do some small perturbation around Schwarzschild, so the cell force in your perturbation theory, you expect that you're not going to deviate much from that. So you expect that post-Newtonian theory is going to be convergent. Now it's in the comparable mass case that it's not clear the question theory is convergent or asymptotic. But I've not discussed that here because here we do a comparison in the circuit.
Well, Nico is not here, so he would have. We made some comparisons of some physical quantities like the energy flux in the extreme mass ratio, and it's asymptotic in that case as well. There's also a paper by Eric from 1998. So the series seems to be asymptotic also in the.
So you see that in the exact set Schwarzschild limit, it's not asymptotic, and then you do a slight deviation and beam, it becomes asymptotic already.
No, it is asymptotic. We computed the energy flux in Schwarzschild and compared with different post-Newtonian orders. It's known up to 5.5 pm, I think. And it is asymptotic. We can talk about it.
Yeah, there's a proof by David Petrov that it converges for post-Newtonian expansion for Newtonian spheroids convergence. There's a whole sequence to be but that's an equilibrium. There can certainly be a difference between. You could imagine that there was just a straight-out difference between the equilibrium sequence and the sequence and any time dependent.
And you know, you were talking about flux, you were talking about the energy function itself, and it could be that one is asymptotic
and the other is
convergent.
I'd like to make a comment going back to Leo's presentation this morning. he showed that comparing to post-Newtonian, he needed log terms, but to get a good fit, he could fit without log terms using some Paré approximant. There's no way that you can sum an infinite number of log terms to get a function of x that doesn't have a loss. So it seems to me that if he has a good fit without logs, it can't be converted series, must be asymptotic.
But that's a good fit within some finite error bars.
Well, error bars that were, you know, far good enough to be able to show that the log terms that you can calculate are actually there.
So we should now stop the discussion. It's time for our next talk.